This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 50 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. In today's episode, Red Rigel, a detective for a major city, speaks on the subject of community policing. Here's your hosts, Woody, without the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome to another edition of the Kinky Cast. The Beast is under the weather tonight, so you have to put up with me. And on the phone, I have Red Rigel. How are you, Rigel?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm good. We have a interesting subject on deck tonight. The subject reads, "You are not the police. The hazards of investigating consent or abuse allegations within the scene." Rigel authored this on FetLife and has got a lot of comments in the thread. And so I wanted to talk with him a little bit because it's an important thing that's going on right now. Rigel comes to us as a working police detective. And so in this case, he is the police. So welcome, Rigel.
Thank you.
When you wrote this piece, what was your intent?
Well, I kind of have to give a little backstory for it. So I'm out in the Baltimore, D.C. metro here. We have a very active, very awesome community out here. So around the time that I wrote this article, maybe a little while before, we had some very serious abuse allegations start popping up against an individual who was very involved in the community out here. And it was multiple allegations. It wasn't just one person involved. And, you know, we have a bunch of really awesome leaders and organizers out here trying to do their best to protect, you know, the people who go to their events or their venues or things like that, had done a lot of almost kind of an independent investigation into what had happened. So stuff from, like, interviewing witnesses, you know, the people involved in the case, a lot of things along those lines without getting into it too much. And they all had really good intentions doing it. And this case eventually actually went to a criminal prosecution. As far as I know, the person involved actually wound up getting convicted. You know, the stuff that happened, you know, previously in the scene, to my knowledge, didn't wind up affecting the criminal case at all when that came around. However, I had seen, you know, from my professional perspective, a lot of things that could have become potential problems. So I authored that, you know, kind of with that that circumstance in mind to kind of bring some of those things up as I saw where it could present, you know, problems down the road for people investigating stuff on their own within the scene.
I've seen on FetLife a lot of times something will come up, whether it's abuse or whether it's even an accident in a scene, and a lot of people will jump on it and, you know, either support or condemn the person that is being accused. I'm using that in quotes. And how does this affect a real investigation?
It can affect it in a ton of ways. I guess my question is, before I get to that, is what specifically are you talking about? Are you talking as far as stuff being on FetLife, as far as things being done specifically with people, you know, kind of investigating stuff on their own? I mean, what exactly is the question that you're asking?
There's actually two tiers. There's the local scene where people will have meetings and discuss this and drum people out of the local communities. And then there's also the FetLife, to where it goes from local to regional to national in about 10 clicks. And so you have two very different types of reactions.
I guess maybe more starting on kind of a local side. The stuff that's online that you see pop up online in reference to that kind of stuff, I don't think most of that really is going to necessarily affect a police investigation, you know, unless it's stuff talking about stuff that people did trying to look into it themselves, and that kind of gets brought up later than that might. I think, you know, the stuff online, you can argue, you know, good, bad, or indifferent depending on, you know, what actually happened in the situation. But as far as the local stuff, my main couple of places that I see potential issues down the road, if you have, and it really depends on how things are handled, but my primary concern would be the integrity of, you know, the victim or the witnesses down the road. There's a lot of things where it's easy for, try not to use the word corrupted, but it's easy to corrupt you know, eyewitnesses to something. And I'm not saying that corruption, like a bad, you know, behavioral kind of sense, but just in terms of, you know, their testimony becoming either, you know, contaminated by somebody else's question, somebody else's recollection of what happened, or even just the idea that that can give to, you know, a judge or a jury or an attorney later down the road when that comes to court, when they hear that, you know, the types of things that have been asked of them before and the other people that may have been asked around, especially if you get, like, people, maybe you have multiple witnesses who have, like, talked in a group about what had happened. You know, those can all be very problematic things down the road in a criminal case.
So does the average person have the training or experience to get in and pipe in on this?
I don't think the average person... Let me put it this way. I don't think that we in the scene in general have the resources or the knowledge to adequately investigate serious allegations within the scene. Now, I don't want that to be taken to say that we shouldn't do anything. I organize some events. I've been involved in organizing events, various events, you know, and groups and classes and various things like that since shortly after I came into the scene. As somebody who runs something like that, you know, you have a definite responsibility to the people who attend your events or your munch or your classes or whatever it is, you know, to their safety. And I think a lot of times we have to take action on things that, you know, we aren't necessarily 100% sure on, that we might never be 100% sure on, you know, the quote-unquote guilt or innocence of that person, and we still have to take action. But as far as determining definitively what have happened, especially when you're talking serious cases, I think it's very, very difficult in most circumstances for the scene to do that internally.
So many members of the scene, well, they don't have training. They don't have official training as a police department would offer, and they're going in, and even viewing a situation, you can watch something go down and ask 10 different people and get 10 different answers on what happened.
Absolutely. No question. I think, you know, kind of, and I'll go back to kind of what I wrote. I see two main problems with us investigating internally within the scene, you know, serious offenses, especially ones that might later wind up coming to court. The first is which, you know, we in the scene don't have really any access to search warrants or crime labs or, you know, any of the other things that, you know, I might in my professional life use to try and find evidence other than eyewitness testimony. So really, you know, when we're investigating stuff in the scene, most of the time we're stuck purely with just the views and perspectives of the people who were involved and what happened. You know, you have the quote-unquote victim, the quote-unquote suspect, and, you know, any other people who may have been around at the time. And we're really stuck with their view, their version of what it is that happened. And, you know, without any kind of, you know, other evidence besides just people's views on what happened, it can be really, really hard to try and figure out you know, where the truth lies. And especially, you know, as far as most people in the scene don't have any specific training to interview or deal with people or try and figure that out just from listening to people talk and tell what happened.
Rigel, in your article, you have a line that says, everybody lies. What do you mean by that?
I mean, everybody lies. And I don't mean that in, like, a mean, offensive way. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, none of us really get through the day without telling some kind of lie or practicing some level of deception. So everybody lies, and it's not always intentional, and it's not always flat out on the level of a lie. You know, there's other ways to deceive without telling a bold-faced lie. You can, you know, omit something and just not say it at all. You can kind of try and minimize it. So everybody goes through their day telling, you know, little lies to themselves and to other people. You know, and the other thing, too, is that the reasons people lie for aren't always reasons that make sense to us. I've seen people admit to really, really doing really horrible crimes, but they lie about why they did it, maybe because they find it embarrassing. Trying to guess when somebody might be lying based upon, you know, what we think the reasons might be, you know, has its own whole set of problems.
So that kind of goes with the next one is, like it or not, false reports happen.
They do. And this honestly was one of the most controversial pieces of this. So I will try and touch on it without talking numbers too much, because the fact of the matter is I don't view the numbers as potentially relevant to the argument. I have personally, in my professional life, seen plenty of false reports, With that being said, when I wrote the article, I went and I had pulled some numbers from some victim advocacy organizations and kind of pointed to those. And I don't remember them offhand, but I think it was maybe somewhere between 5% and 10% when talking about sexual assault. I kind of have two arguments with that, I think, which is first and foremost, common sense to me would say that in an environment like the community where there really isn't any kind of consequences for making a false report, we're probably just through common sense going to have a higher ratio than, you know, somebody actually going and making a report to a police officer where, you know, if they it gets found out that they were making that up, that they could be hit up with a false report. But the other end to that, to me, is that regardless of what you want to say the actual numbers are, because the fact of the matter is, you know, we can find as many different numbers on that as we can find reports. And most of them, I think, do say that false reports for sexual assault are fairly low. But to me, if we're saying that, you know, we really don't have the ability within the scene to figure out if the person that we're talking to is telling the truth or not, then any kind of percentage of false report is something that I think we should be concerned about, and we should kind of keep in our mind when we're dealing with some of this stuff.
A lot of people can be hurt by a false report.
They can. And, you know, and just, and I mean, and a lot of people can be hurt by a false report. And I have seen in my career, you know, I have seen people go to prison for, you know, either through witnesses who were flat out lying, or through witnesses who were, you know, well-intentioned but mistaken, mistaken identity, that sort of thing. And, you know, and there's definitely, I think, a lot of consequences to false reports, you know, particularly in the criminal justice system. And I think that there is definitely some consequences, you know, though not as severe, for people in the scene. And, you know, again, I think that's something that we should kind of consider and keep in mind when dealing with these incidents.
What is the difference between lies and deception in this case?
Like I said, you know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, a lot of times when people, some of us think that we're pretty good at figuring out when people are lying to us, and some people are better than others. I think statistics have shown that you've got pretty much random chance, pretty much as good as tossing a coin up in the air, you've got to figure out if somebody's lying to you. But, you know, the other issue is that when you're talking to somebody about an incident that happened, you know, like I said before, they may not lie. It's less psychologically taxing to use what, you know, I would consider a lesser form of deception. You know, when you leave something out of a story or you minimize something that happened or, you know, there's little things you can do like that, they don't take as big of a psychological toll on the person who is telling what happened. So, you know, when people are given the opportunity, most of the time, even when they're being deceptive, they won't lie. They'll just bend the story a certain way. And I think that's, you know, I think that's the reason that I think that's an important thing to realize is because just because a person isn't bold-faced lying to you doesn't mean that what they're telling you is, you know, A, necessarily the truth, but B, I think more importantly when we're talking about this kind of stuff, even if they're being truthful, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're being accurate.
A while back, I saw a TV show called Brain Games, and they had done a staged mugging with a group of people observing it. And then afterwards, they had a trained detective go in and interview each person to see what they actually saw. And it was amazing. And so that's the next point that you have here. Even when being honest, what people remember is never what actually happened.
Never. And, you know, and this, I think, is the most important thing because I think that, you know, like I said, false reports happen. I don't think we should discount them. And I don't think that it really does us good as a community to pretend that it doesn't. But with that being said, you know, I don't think most situations that we run into, even situations that we run into where what the person is telling us isn't accurate, you know, isn't people trying to lie or trying to, you know, make a false report against this person, you know, a lot of times what people remember, as you said, is never what actually happens. If I have a crime that happens and I have five different witnesses, I will have five different stories. And even down to really simple details, and this is when everybody's being cooperative, and I'll have the person described five different ways, and, you know, I may have well-meaning people who make identifications of different people as the same person. You know, our minds aren't like photographs. The best kind of phrase that I've heard when talking about human memory is creative reimagining. You know, we kind of store little bits and pieces of what happened in our brain, and then as we go back and we remember stuff, our brain fills in a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, and kind of like our biases and our prejudices and a whole bunch of other things, our life experiences all kind of play into what we wind up remembering. The other issue with that is, you know, when you're talking about remembering is, and it's not just remembering that's the problem, we also really don't pay a lot of attention to the world around us, and we usually think that we're paying a lot more attention to it than we actually are. And there's been a lot of really interesting studies as far as things like where they've, like, had a person talking to somebody and duck behind a desk and somebody pop up and finish the conversation. The person doesn't even realize they're talking to somebody else, you know, things along those lines. So, yeah, there's a lot of really serious things to consider, even when you're talking about people who are trying to be honest and trying to be helpful. You know, they're not always going to be right.
The sensory system of the human body is dealing with so much data coming in that the brain can't possibly store it all, and so it does a form of compression and actually just throwing a lot of it away. And then it's made up when a question is asked, you know, what actually happened here. And so people are pulling little factoids back together and then trying to stitch them into a story.
Yeah, they do. And people, and I said they don't do it on purpose, and people, we don't realize that we do it. And, you know, we've all had that conversation either like with a spouse or a partner where, you know, we have a conversation. I do it in my personal life all the time where we have a conversation with somebody and then we go back and then you're arguing over what was actually said. And you both think something completely different was said. So it's a definite issue. And that's where I think kind of starting to tie some stuff together, we run into what I see as one of the major issues with people in the scene trying to do like a really heavy independent investigation, which is because our brains work that way, when you ask questions the wrong way or the wrong questions, you can wind up creating memories or affecting those memories by the questions that you're asking. And the best way that I can kind of, an example that I use for this, I have a kid, I don't know how many people have kids, but, you know, that are listening, but, you know, if you have a child or a child that you've been around a lot, say you have something that they did when they were really little, and you have told they do something funny, and you told this story all while they're growing up about what they did. Well, they start thinking they remember that, even though it was far too early for them to actually remember. And people do the same thing. So if you put a group of people in a room, and I'm, you know, I'm saying this as somebody who's done it, if you take three or four people and you put them together in a room, if I have them and I've interviewed them first separately, and they've told me they're four different stories because they all remember things four different ways, even though they're trying to be honest. If I then put them in a room and I talk to them and I let them kind of conversate with me, they will all eventually come to remember the same thing just by having that conversation and kind of filling in the gaps for each other. And their stories will all start to converge. This is where I think that we run into a really serious potential problem when talking about this is, you know, if this is handled the wrong way and it does eventually later become a criminal case, you've probably changed the way that the answers that this person is going to give. And that may wind up being a serious deal because if they now, say, remember something that didn't actually happen, they may look like they're lying or making the whole thing up. We're just, I think, getting to a point where it's a real possibility for victims of abuse who are in the BDSM lifestyle to go to the police. And the last thing that we want is them to have the courage to take that step and then not be believed because, you know, now their story no longer makes sense.
So you have the average person observing some incident. You have a group of people that have conversed on the incident and filled in the blanks in their own mind. And then the third version of this would be a pathological liar who makes things up and actually convinces themselves that it happened.
That's always a possibility. Same thing as people with mental disorders, people with schizophrenia or some other things. They don't, I mean, the other problem becomes that when people believe that they're telling the truth, whether they're actually telling the truth or not, they don't look like they're lying. I don't know, you know, to be completely honest, I would hazard to say, and again, false reports do happen. I don't think it does any good to ignore that. But I would hazard to say that I think the majority of the time, a lot of this stuff is not as black and white as somebody flat out making up an accusation. I think a lot of times what we see is more of a situation that kind of goes into that gray area, and you know, the way that we get people remembering kind of determines if it's okay or not. Good example would be, you know, you have a negotiation, and people are remembering that negotiation a little differently. I think definitely if you get a pathological liar, you know, you definitely will have that problem. I would say, you know, that doesn't account for, I think, the majority of things that we see, though.
No, but it's a third case, and it could happen.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not, like I said, and just as well, I've interviewed schizophrenic people who absolutely believe all kinds of things, and it's very difficult to talk to them because, you know, they're not lying. They're telling the absolute truth in their own mind. Yeah, that's absolutely another possible case.
So in all these situations, where's the accused? Where do they stand in this whole thing?
Well, I think one of the kind of the major issues with looking at this stuff in the scene is most of the time, you know, the kind of instance that we see, there's really only two people involved. There's, you know, the person who, I can't think of better words than, again, to say the quote-unquote victim and the quote-unquote suspect. You know, those are the two people involved. Occasionally you might have another, maybe somebody else around who saw what happened. But generally you're dealing with two, maybe a couple more people, and that's really it. In a criminal case, you go and you talk to that person in a criminal investigation, and you get their version of what happened. And it may absolutely confirm that, yes, they did do this. It may raise some questions for you to kind of go back and look at some things that were told to you before. But most of the time, when stuff's handled internally in the scene, that person a lot of times is never talked to. Not that I necessarily recommend that we talk to them, because, you know, trying to talk to somebody who is actively being deceptive and, you know, has actually done something serious is really, even more so than talking to a normal person, a very specific skill set that most people, you know, don't have. But I do think that not talking to them then leaves a huge blank spot in something that really is mostly, you know, one, maybe two people's word against another. You really need to get all sides of the story if you're going to kind of make a decision on that, on what happened.
So is the road to hell paved with good intentions?
Possibly, I think. I think possibly it is. Again, this was kind of, when I wrote this, it was in response to a very specific situation that happened. I want to even say a very thorough, very active, kind of independent community investigation into something that was likely eventually going to turn into a criminal matter. And I think in those circumstances, yeah, there's a lot of potential issues. Again, if something like this, the victim does get up the courage and this actually does wind up going to court, that could arise from something being investigated in that way.
So despite your best intentions, what good are you doing? You may well cause serious damage to a current or future criminal case if the community gets too involved in this.
From a lot of different perspectives, because it's certainly not that we shouldn't do anything at all. Going about things that route and having a very strong independent investigation, kind of going around, interviewing the different witnesses within the community, trying to accumulate evidence and stuff, that stuff could have some very detrimental effects on a case that's going to a criminal trial. And, you know, was kind of the, honestly, that's kind of the main thrust of why I wrote this, was looking at this from a perspective of, if this came across my desk and, you know, I'm trying to get this charged and get this to a prosecutor and get this taken to trial, what problems are going to arise for me from the way that this was handled?
You don't need any barricades in the road.
No, absolutely not. Like I said, especially, we're just really getting to a point in the last couple of years, you know, kink's becoming much more widely accepted. We're no longer classified as having, you know, mental disorders purely for what we do. And in a lot of areas in the country, you know, I think we are getting to a point where some of these more serious abuse allegations can be taken to the police. And I don't think that it's really fair to the victim, you know, to put any more barriers in their way than, you know, are already there if they decide to do that.
You're in a big city market. Kink becomes more mainstream in the larger cities, both on the East and West Coast. You get in the middle of the country, in the small towns, where you have smaller police departments that are not as hip as you are, you're going to have issues.
Possibly. Well, I think there's a couple things to that. First and foremost, I tell people all the time, you know, I'm not going to lie, I am under no illusions about the criminal justice system. There is nothing worse than a bored cop. So I think partially, I think somewhat it has to do with political and religious views, depending on where you're at in the country, you know, how conservative you're in. I think it also just partially has to do with how bored the police are where you're at, you know. Absolutely. I think if you're in some of the more politically conservative, smaller cities in the Bible Belt area, very conservative leaning, I definitely think you're going to run into more problems than if you're in big city, liberal area, East Coast, West Coast kind of place. But there are resources that you can kind of use to reach out and, you know, and help you with that. I guess, kind of, as I said before, you know, my main concern with writing this was the implications of what this could have on a criminal case if things aren't handled correctly. So kind of a few of the main problems that I see from my professional perspective, you know, first and foremost is getting the victim to go to the police in the first place. I have somewhat of a concern. And first, let me say, you know, that absolutely whether or not somebody's going to go to the police is wholly dependent on the victim and what they're comfortable with. However, you know, if that's something that they are comfortable with and they are willing to do, you know, the police are really the people with the resources to both investigate and go through the criminal justice system and hand down consequences, you know, if it's something along those lines. So, you know, if the person is willing to do that, part of my concern is that purely you have somebody who's willing to go to the police, but if it's a more comfortable situation for this person to come to the community and they feel that it's being investigated and handled by the community, that they may not take that step in going to the police that they were otherwise willing to take. I think that that can, I think that somewhat provides a false sense of security, both for, I think, the person and kind of the whole scene in general. A couple of the other things, you know, that I think are kind of concerning. First off, as I said before, if you've really sat down, you've really over and over again talked to this victim or maybe any witnesses who saw it, or kind of worse yet, actually let them talk all together so they've all kind of come to somewhat of a similar conclusion, their stories most likely aren't going to sound right to somebody who's experienced. The details aren't going to be right. They're going to be remembering things they shouldn't remember. They're going to be remembering things inaccurately. Stories are going to be too similar. That could pose serious questions for an investigator about the truth of what's being told to them. A couple of other concerns that I have is the community kind of leaks really bad, at least around here, and I would assume in most of the community. So the person kind of getting word that something's going on, that an accusation has been made against them within the community, they may decide to, you know, intimidate the victim, or maybe, you know, if there is something, someone incriminating. I mean, I think maybe the easiest example in a situation like, you know, we might see in the scene might be like kind of text messages talking about what happened or something along those lines, you know. They might go ahead and get rid of those things because they're worried the police are going to come looking. So you have that. And, you know, I think finally is whenever you take a case and you make it more complicated, you throw in now a bunch of additional people. Maybe they've got to be called as witnesses, these people who are doing their independent investigations. You know, maybe they came up with some stuff that's kind of contradictory to itself, I guess, is more so the problem. When, you know, you start looking at taking these things to court, complicated cases are harder to prosecute. You know, you have more avenues for a defense attorney to attack. You have more points for the case to possibly fail. And, you know, it's not something that people very much like to admit, but the truth of the matter is, you know, detectives, as detectives and investigators, you know, we're judged based on our clearance rate. You know, the number of cases that we have versus the number of cases that we've solved. When you get a prosecutor, and you're talking about a prosecutor who's actually taking us to court or a district attorney, whatever you're calling them, you know, in the jurisdiction where you're at, and, you know, this may not be officially, but realistically, they're judged based off of their conviction rate. They're judged based off of the number of cases that they take to trial versus the number of cases that they get convictions on. And when they're looking at cases that have been made weaker by the involvement of other people, you know, it gives them a motivation to maybe offer a plea for a really light sentence or maybe just never to even charge the case at all. And, you know, I think those are all really, really serious concerns. And I think they're things that people should be aware of when they're thinking about, you know, trying to get involved in a case like this that might wind up going criminal.
That's good advice. After a case is charged, what should the community do at that point?
A lot, depending on the circumstances. But, you know, what I will say is I think it's important to realize that you have a case that is looks like, again, it's a serious case. It may wind up going to something criminal. And, you know, say you hold off on really digging down into a lot of stuff and waiting for the case to be charged. And I'm saying this because I kind of saw this some, you know, in a couple things locally. And then, you know, so the case gets charged, and then there's kind of a push, well, okay, now the case has been charged. The people have been interviewed, you know, by the detectives. More than likely, maybe their statements they've given been memorialized in some form. You know, is now a good time to go ahead and start really digging into this stuff, interviewing these people, trying to come up with this stuff on our own? My suggestion, I think for the criminal case, a better time to do it than before they've been interviewed and before stuff's ever been filed. But, you know, one thing that I would say to keep in mind is, you know, if the trial hasn't happened yet, the possibility of, you don't want what you're doing to be brought up in trial. You know, you don't want the witness to be, or victim to be sitting on the stand and the defense attorney to be able to ask them, you know, well, you sat down and discussed it with this person, this person, this person, this person, and they told you to say this stuff. So I think it's just something to keep in mind, is that just because the case has been charged, you know, to still keep in mind that what you're doing, depending on how you're doing it, could wind up affecting that court case that's coming up.
That's great advice. So there is an elephant in the room. Those who get falsely accused.
I think, and I say it's the elephant in the room because we don't like to admit that it happens. I think it's important to realize that, again, despite the fact that it may be a low number, especially people who get, I would say, who get falsely accused, like, purposefully, it does happen. And I don't think that pretending it doesn't happen does us any good as a community. And, you know, I think I'm coming from a certain place on this. And, you know, I'll actually, and it's not something I like to talk about very much, but I'll talk about it for the purpose of this. You know, in my career, I have had two cases where I know for a fact that the people who were accused, both of whom went to jail, turned out not to have done it. One case, it was intentional. One case, it was a series of coincidences and some very mistaken witnesses. But I've seen it happen personally. I have personally had people I have sent to jail, and it has come up later that those were not the people who did it. And, you know, had to go ahead and get the charges against these people dropped. So, you know, I think it's important to realize that it does happen. And, you know, when it does happen, it could have very serious effects for the people involved. And I don't think we should, as I said, I don't think it does any good to the community to deny it and pretend that that isn't a possibility.
I was involved with one of those situations in my kink life. I was ready to condemn the person, and then all the facts came in, and they were innocent. I am judge and jury ready to slam a gavel down.
You know, and I think the thing with that, too, and I don't know if this is the same as in your case, but, you know, what I try and get across with this is because when people hear me say that, a lot of times the reaction is, well, most of the time victims aren't going to make stuff up, they aren't going to lie, they aren't going to falsely accuse people. And I'll agree that's true most of the time, not all the time, but most of it. But the thing that I don't think that is taken into account is there's a difference between the victim purposefully trying to accuse somebody and make something up, and maybe all the facts about what happened just not coming out right for one reason or another. And, you know, that can lead us to a false conclusion just as quickly as somebody who's actually trying to lie. So, you know, I don't know if it's the same thing in your situation, but, I think that's definitely something to keep in mind as well.
So what are your suggestions to make things go smoother?
Okay, so I have a few things. And I will say first off that with the situation that happened, I had primarily written this from the perspective of an organizer, an event, or a venue, or something along those lines. But I'll tell you what, I'll actually throw in a couple of things as well from some of the stuff that I teach, you know, regarding just interacting with the police. So I'll take this into, I guess, kind of two sections. I'll take this into first as far as a victim, and then secondly, my suggestions professionally as far as an organizer or promoter or somebody who's approached, because I think that's the best way to do it. As a victim, I think, again, that, as I said before, it really, the only person who can decide if it's right for the victim to go to the police is the victim, and I don't think there's any onus on them to do so. I do think that it is important for us to realize and to consider that most of these people, if you have an actual predator, not somebody who's made a one-time mistake and learned from it, but if you have an actual predator, you know, most of these people are repeat offenders. So I do think that's something important for people to keep in mind when going to the police, that possibility of maybe building up these steps so that maybe this doesn't happen to somebody further down the road. Again, that's one of the things that I don't think does us any good to ignore, that it's a fact that most of these people are repeat offenders. However, you know, it's really the only person who can decide if it's right for the victim to go to the police is the victim. And again, you know, as I said, I deal with the criminal justice system under no illusions. And a lot of the stuff that we do, or some of the complaints that pop up aren't necessarily things that the police are going to handle. He spanked my ass versus my thighs kind of a thing. You know, those aren't things that the police are going to get involved in. So I think it's really important for the victim to kind of sit down and consider everything involved and whether or not that's something they want to do and they're willing to do. If they are willing to do it, there are some good resources. I highly, highly recommend the NCSF. They are a wonderful organization. They can get in touch with the police in your area for you, which might be a good thing, especially if you're in maybe, as you were saying, one of the more conservative parts of the country that's likely to be a little more hostile to you. And it kind of, I think it kind of can give, getting a call from an advocacy organization, I think, can kind of, especially if you're in a difficult area, kind of put them on the police on notice to be on their best behavior. So there's that. There's also certain victim advocacy organizations that aren't the NCSF, but that do have experience with kink, and you can find them on the NCSF's website. Some of those organizations, I think they have a listing by state. Something else that I recommend is if you have somebody who's involved in law enforcement or criminal justice in your area who's maybe willing to bring it to the police for you, they might not, depends on how comfortable they are with their career. But the other thing as well is a lot of, especially if you're in a larger city, a lot of organizations now have LGBT liaison units. And a lot of times the people that are involved in those units have some sort of experience with kink or at least friendly. I was involved in a venue that got raided several years ago out in D.C., and the D.C.'s LGBT liaison unit came out, and one of the officers was talking to us about this boy he met at the Crucible the week before. So, you know, that may be a resource available if you're in a larger city. They probably won't handle the case directly themselves, but they can probably send it to the right person and, again, kind of put them on notice to be on their best behavior and kind of take your complaint seriously. So those are kind of my suggestions as far as victims. I do think we've come a long way. I do think that you can, as I said, go to the police successfully and in serious cases now and be taken seriously even though you're involved in kink. And there's definitely some organizations like the NCSF out there to help you if you go that route. From an organizer's perspective, a few things. First and foremost, if it's an immediate thing, is to, you know, see that they get any kind of medical or other attention that they need. I like to say, you know, you're not the police, you're also not a doctor, right, or a psychiatrist. So if they need medical attention, making sure they get that. If they need, you know, psychological assistance from what happened, you know, it may not be immediate, maybe something further down the road. You know, you may be a good ear, but you're probably not a counselor. If it's a serious thing, it may not hurt, you know, to kind of point them in the right direction. With that as well, I'm going to have to bump the NCSF again on this, but I know they have a Kink Aware Professionals section on their website that where you can actually go and find counselors and doctors and stuff in your area that are kink-friendly.
It's a great resource. Absolutely.
It is a wonderful, wonderful resource. And it's, you know, having, just on a general note, having kink-friendly doctors to begin with can be an amazing thing and save you possibly some trouble with police in the first place. But that's kind of on a separate note. So there's that. You know, if you are a victim, you know, in addition to the police, is venues and stuff where you go, where this person goes, organizations you go to, this person goes, give those organizers a heads up. They need to know to keep those events safe for you and for other people. A lot of times, in most areas, the organizers do kind of talk among themselves somewhat. So, you know, if something serious happened to you, you know, chances are that'll get around to the other organizers so they can have a heads up about this person. And to, if nothing else, keep an eye out to try and make sure that nobody gets hurt. Back to the flip side of that, speaking as an organizer, I don't recommend that organizers do any kind of full-blown scale investigations. Like, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to interview these witnesses three times, I'm going to try and come up with, like, screenshots and evidence and stuff like that. I don't recommend that. We're not equipped for it. Don't want to risk screwing up a criminal case if that happens. But as organizers, it is, and I'm just going to use the word ours here because I am one, it is our responsibility to protect those people at our event. That probably means asking some questions, you know, and there's definitely a balance there, I think, between asking nothing and really going full-blown into fields that you may not be qualified to tread into. Asking questions and keeping people out from your event. And, you know, I know that personally, and I think for most event organizers, something doesn't have to rise to a criminal level of certainty, you know, of evidence standards to keep that person out from your events. If you think that person is a hazard to your events, you're a private organization. You need no reason not to have that person there. So that's my recommendation as far as that. I would say I don't recommend, as I said before, doing a full-blown investigation. I personally, because I think of the uncertainties regarding the problems that we have in the scene of collecting evidence, of interviewing people, of those things, and kind of I think the level of uncertainty that leaves us in some of these decisions that we make. As an organizer, if I feel that somebody's dangerous, I'm going to tell the other organizers about it so that they can kind of watch that person to make their decisions as far as organizations. However, I am not going, unless this was a very serious thing that I am very, very certain of, to publicly lambast this person on the internet. Because again, as far as I'm concerned, in most of these situations, we just don't have enough, I personally don't have enough certainty to take that route where I would be comfortable putting that out on the internet for somebody. I would certainly take it around and go to the other organizers, but again, unless I'm absolutely sure, I'm not going to falsely publicly accuse a person myself. I guess that's the easiest way for me to put it. I think there is some truth, too, as far as talking about organizers and, you know, conversations being had and information about possibly troublesome individuals being spared. You know, I think with most of these people, if it isn't a one-time fuck-up kind of a thing, and they are predators, most of these people are repeat offenders, and they do develop habits, and eventually, you know, that will get around to enough of the organizers in an area, you know, to give it a lot of weight. This is my suggestion as well. As an organizer, or as I'd say really anybody, a friend, whatever, who these people are talking to, if you say you're an organizer, you do decide to go through, ask some questions, maybe do a little digging to try and figure out, you know, if this happened, if you're comfortable having this person out at your events, if you need to notify other organizers, this person may be a problem. You decide you need to take that step. My recommendation, don't post what you did online as like, this is what I did this, I talked to these people, these are the conclusions I came to. The last thing you want is that to be printed off and to show up in court, you know, as somebody's defense exhibit that, you know, you had possibly interfered with this investigation and that this victim may be, you know, have kind of had their story shaped by talking to you and that they may not be trustworthy. So if you do decide to take that step, don't post about it online in a public forum.
That is great advice. And with that, I want to thank our guest this evening, Red Rigel, our detective, who has given us a great insight onto the community and not to self-police.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate talking to you and good conversation.
I will have all your links on our Hot Links page, and so people can check out the original article and some of the other things that you've written. I think you bring a great perspective to keep the community safe.
I appreciate it. You know, it's a really touchy topic. I don't know. I think some of it needed to be said.
You have been listening to episode 50 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. Next week we have Beast Siskel and Woody Ebert review 50 years of kinky cinema. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max.